2016-1068, Agility Defense versus United States.
You and me.
I know.
Yeah.
I mean, it was two different things.
Of course.
Okay, Mr. English, please proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court. As the court knows, my name is Brad English, and I represent the appellant, Agility Defense and Government Services. The primary issue in this appeal, as we see it, is the trial court's application of law in a manner that was inconsistent with the facts as it found them to be.
And okay, let me focus you on, because you have a number of issues that you've raised on appeal, and there's one in particular that I really want you to focus on. So that's where, if you don't mind, I'd like you to start.
Certainly.
Which is whether or not there was a negligent estimate of contract provided. And in particular, I guess what perplexed me, and certainly I'll be asking the government when they stand up, what really confused me is that the court made a finding this is a requirements contract. Is that correct?
It did, Your Honor.
And that finding, as I understand it, is undisputed by any party or the government.
That's right, Your Honor.
Okay. So the FAR requires, as I understand it, and that also seems to be undisputed because it's a regulation that's clear on its face, it absolutely requires that in a requirement contract, the government provide an estimate. I've got it here, FAR 16.503.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. So did the government seek or obtain some sort of exception in this case to decline to provide an estimate?
There's no deviation in the record, Your Honor.
Okay. So then what would you say is the estimate that the government provided, which they are required to provide in requirement contracts under the FAR, which I just quoted?
Right. Our position, and the trial court's analysis was there was no estimate. But
so if there was no estimate, that would be really problematic, right?
We thought so, Your Honor.
Okay. All right. So the trial court's finding was there was – that's the part I had trouble reconciling in the trial court's decision, this idea that this historical data, for example, it wasn't really offered as an estimate when the trial court seemed to acknowledge the existence of the FAR regulation that required the government to provide an estimate.
Right. Okay. And that was the problem. In our view, the estimate comprised of two pieces. There was the historical workload and staffing data that...
Even though the government's... I'm sorry. Sure. As you can tell, I sort of know your facts pretty well, so I'm just going to get right to my point.
Absolutely.
So even though the government did provide, when they pointed you to the website for historical data, I think they made some statement to the effect of, you know, we're not saying the historical data represents an estimate as to what the workload requirements will be in future years, right?
Well, it certainly, it said they don't have projections was the answer to the question when they pointed the...
No, but I thought they went further. I thought that they said something to the effect quite clearly that the historical data didn't represent a future projection.
I think it said it was for information only, but there, you know, remember, with respect to the historical data, it was historical, and it broke down workload and scrap weight and also line items, and then showed the number of staff at each dermo that was required to process that workload. But the trial court also found, and it's also undisputed, that in addition to that historical workload data, before offers were submitted, the government provided a projection of workload measured by scrap weight for the base contract year and all four option years. And the testimony at trial was that Agility and presumably the other offers relied on all of that data in developing its staffing requirements and putting together its proposal.
That scrap estimate, I think it's 990 to 991 of the appendix.
I believe that's
in
right.
In July of 2007, did it indicate or something, or was there something with it that indicated one way or the other, this is based on historical estimates adjusted for what we know about the future, or what does it say anything about what the first year scrap estimate is based on?
It doesn't give anything as to the basis of it, Your Honor. The answers to the questions in the Amendment 7, I believe, when that's provided, says expressly, this is provided for assistance in preparing your proposal. That was the purpose it was for which it was provided to the offerors, and that's the purpose for which Agility used it. And where they came up with the information, your honors have seen from my examination of Mr. Washington, who was the head of head of contracting activities for DREMS when this contract was developed and awarded. I asked him pretty expressly, how can you give us an estimate of scrap? And it's very particular. It's the type and the weight for the base year and all 4 years without other estimates of what's coming in the door. And he just flat told us he couldn't.
What is the relationship? And this is, I guess, a question about findings, a question about evidence. I'm not quite sure what's the question about. But the statement at A945, we anticipate an increase in property turn-ins. Mm. So they warned you. This was June 20th, yes. I think. They warned you. We think there will be an increase.
Right. I think that was in an answer to a question in June. And
yes.
Remember, previously they had said we don't have projections. Another offeror asked a question about the fluctuation or variation in workloads, and they said we think it'll increase. And then the last we heard from the government was Amendment 7. The amendment your Honor is asking about is Amendment 4. And so in late July of 07, we get Amendment 7 that has the scrap estimate. And if you read it carefully, it shows constant workloads for the base year and the first option year, and then declining workloads at each dermo over the period of performance.
And that's not what actually happened at all.
No, Your Honor. On day one, as the trial court found, we started at Dermo Arifjan, and there were 70,000 line items on the ground waiting for Agility to process. And if you look at the baseline workload for Arifjan, which was incorporated in the contract,
over 200% higher.
Right. Well, it was 8 months worth of work based on the baseline, not even counting what's coming in. And so for the entire period of performance, measuring the work based on quantities, it was 260% of the workload baselines that offerors were given to prepare their proposals, which were actually incorporated in the contract. And then measured by scrap weight, it's 270%. And we think that it's pretty clear that, and the trial court found, that increase in workload was dramatic and it occurred on day one.
I know, that's the tricky thing about that H-19. I looked at that H-19 and I thought, oh, you guys really got screwed, because it allowed for, if you could renegotiate and ask for more money, if throughout the life of the contract the estimates went way beyond from 1 year to the next what they had been the previous year, more than 50% higher or something, whatever, over a three-month period. But what it didn't address is what happens if day one, out of the blocks, you're slammed with 200% or 300% higher volume of work than historical estimates had suggested would exist. You had absolutely no recourse, as far as I can tell, under H-19 at least. Is
that's our understanding. I think that's really the problem, Your Honor, is, at H-19, as it was expressly written, confusing as it might have been, didn't really contemplate any relief until month four, because you had to have 150% above, which is 250%
months one through three.
Months one through three.
Through three were way off the scales to begin with, right. You could never reach that limit.
And I take it your position about H-19, this is, I guess, a legal issue that the government raises that the Court of Federal Claims didn't address, is that H-19 simply does not speak to errors affecting day one, like the bad estimate, the negligent estimate, the inaccurate. So it doesn't exhaust the field of remedies as to problems that occur on day one.
Absolutely, Your Honor. The disputes clause was in the contract, and nothing about H-19 said we also lose our normal contract rights. But even if H-19 applied on day one, if you do the math, and it's in our brief, we met it. As incredible as that sounds, because if you take the 9,100 line items that would have been the baseline workload, and then you take the 70,000 line items that the trial court found were on the ground in day one.
You didn't argue this on appeal, right? You're explaining right now that you met H-19, but you didn't. I don't remember you arguing to us in your appeal brief that the lower court erred because you met H-19 and therefore you should have received an equitable adjustment based on having satisfied Clause H-19.
We didn't really say anything about H-19 because the trial court didn't reach it, but this point is in the brief, the mathematical calculation that I'm explaining now. The 9,100 line items that would have been the baseline at Dermo Arifjan, if you multiply that by 250%, it's about 22,000 line items. And then to meet the metric, you have to have that workload extending for 3 months. And if you divide just the 70,000 line items that were on the ground by the 22,000 line items that would have been the product of 9,100 times...
Oh, my God, blah, 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 these numbers. Forget it.
It's over 3 months.
And so, this is a classic force majeure case, the force majeure being the Iranians providing new types of shape charge IEDs to the folks who are creating all your scrap for you?
Right. Well, you know, it certainly was a situation where whatever the reason, you know, it's undisputed. Again, the trial court made these findings that we think, if you apply the law, require a finding of entitlement. The trial court found that the sole reason that the government decided to outsource the operation of these dermos in the first place was because it sat down in late 2006 and said, we're going to get more work than our current staff can handle. But when it told us to bid, when it gave us the information to bid to the or submit proposals, it let us bid to requirements that its current staff could handle.
Can I ask you with a particular question about the relation between the three different claims you have?
Right.
I understand the negligent estimate claim is the A990-91 was negligently incorrect. They told you it was going to be level and then actually drop. That was careless. I understand the variant of that says that very same representation was a unreasonably inaccurate warranty. What in addition is there to the claim of, I guess it's your first claim, failure to disclose superior knowledge?
Right. And that's what I was just hitting on, Your Honor. They had us, you know, the whole reason that DREMS was motivated to outsource this work was they knew there was a tidal wave of work coming. That's the trial court's finding. DLA director determined in late 06 that we're not going to be able to handle the work that was coming. And when they set up the contract and provided information that they expressly intended offerors to rely on, the requirements that offerors were told to bid to were not the requirements that they expected to come.
They said you have to have Section 5, the ability to handle surges. This was a surge.
Certainly, Your Honor, but we were in surge in day one. And so when you just look at the information, we didn't get to step foot on the ground. There was, like I said, 9 months of work on the ground as the trial court found it, and we were not entitled to any more staff, according to DREMS, when we kept asking for additional personnel.
You're into your rebuttal time. Do you want to save it?
I would like to save it.
Very good.
Thank you.
Mr. Austin? Please proceed.
May it please the court. I listened to Mr. English's argument, and there's one key fact that Mr. English omitted. The government knew that this contract placed high risk upon the contractor. The government, though, was not careless, was not just saying, well, you bid on it. There was two mechanisms in the contract to aid the contractor in this performance. The first was Clause H-19. The court did not reach Clause H-19 because while during the first few months of the contract, the parties had a disagreement or negotiations as to the applicability of Clause H-19, prior to bid, Agility never inquired about H-19. The language was plain and patent on its face. Therefore, if they suspected that there was a problem, they had a duty to inquire before bid opening. They didn't. The court therefore said, I'm not going to reach H-19 because Agility waived it. But that wasn't the only benefit.
The problem, I guess, I have with that is that H-19, by its terms, is only about changes between what's starting, between day one and day four, or month one and month four, et cetera. It's not about what went wrong on day one as a result of deficient, to use a general term, information that went into their bid. It just doesn't address that situation.
Your Honor, when you speak of deficient information, we look...
We're covering all three claims.
Yes, Your Honor, sir. I understand that. But when we look at what was to be expected upon day one, the contract, the proposal, the solicitation, everything was silent as to the workload to be expected on day one.
Except the scrap estimate was not silent.
Your Honor, when we look at the scrap estimate, we have to look at it in the totality of the proposal. When you look at Amendment 4, Question 11, where it stated that property turn-ins would increase, you have to balance that against the scrap estimates, which would say that the workload or the scrap estimates would remain constant over the first 2 years and decrease over the third year. So that leads to three possibilities. One, the workload would increase, property turn-ins. Two, it remained constant. And three, it would decrease. This was a firm fixed price contract.
Wait, stop. I thought that it wasn't appealed that this was a requirements contract. I thought the lower court held this was a requirements contract, and I saw no appeal from any party disputing the finding that it was a requirements contract.
That's correct, Your Honor. It was a firm fixed price requirements contract.
Which requires under FAR 16.503 the government to provide an estimate. Is that correct? Am I misunderstanding the FAR regulation?
No, Your Honor, but when you look at 48 CFR 16503A1.
Where do I have it right here.
It states at the beginning that the government is to provide a realistic estimate. Down near the end of the clause, however, it says that the government can obtain the estimates from historical data.
Well, see, I guess the problem I have with that is this. I will stipulate, just for the purposes of this point, that it might be possible to read that second sentence in its language that, given the historical data, no matter what that historical data actually tells you about the future. But why in the world would we read it that way when the whole point is you have to give your best estimate of the future? And if a company in a securities context or something knew of an event that made yesterday's news no longer an accurate estimate for the future, it couldn't say, well, we'll just tell you what's and was under a requirement to prognosticate the future. It couldn't say, well, yesterday this is what happened.
Your Honor.
Sometimes that's enough and sometimes it isn't. But here there's some reason to think actually it wasn't. Things were changing.
Your Honor, there are actually two aspects to your point. And the first is, was there another way that the government could have presented the what they wanted through the contract? And the answer is yes, they could have. But that begs the question in terms of what did the government do? And the government provided, in lieu of trying to predict the future, they said, okay, here is the current and historical workload data. You, Mr. Contractor, you have to determine whether it would increase, remain the same, or decrease.
Time out. I don't see how that's consistent with FAR 16.503, which requires the contracting officer to give a realistic estimate. It then says the contracting officer may obtain the realistic estimate from records of previous requirements of consumption or by any other means, utilizing the most current information available. So it doesn't divorce the idea that historical data can be used, certainly it can, but only when that historical data is going to provide a realistic estimate. That seems to be clearly and unequivocally required by this FAR regulation. I just don't see any room for any other interpretation. And if that is the interpretation, how did the government satisfy that?
And I'd like to throw in this question. Was the estimate realistic?
Your Honor, when you and I understand the your question, but when we look at what the government did, almost by definition, using the historical and current data, and it was out a year in the past, then that is almost by definition realistic because it was the actual workload data. Agility can't point to one aspect of the historical or current data that was not known to Agility. And Agility knew that it was a high-risk contract, and that leads to the second point that I was mentioning
earlier. Did they know they were walking in with that volume of work on the first day?
Your Honor, in terms of that, they were able to do a pre-bid survey. And even though it wasn't a major factor at trial, there was testimony that the government had stopped processing property a week or 2 weeks prior to Agility taking over contract performance. There was testimony from Mr. Marlo Burns, who was a contracting officer representative, who did an analysis of the property turn-in from approximately January of 2008 through March of 2008, when Agility took over, and he found that there was 10,000 to 15,000 line items, or that it was only a short period. But set that aside, the contract is silent on what is to be expected of day one. It did not state that upon day one you would have zero workload, so you plan it. They had to anticipate increase, remain the same, or decrease. But, Your Honor, the most important aspect of the solicitation is that there was a provision where Agility could sell the scrap metal that they disposed of, and they could keep the proceeds free and clear. They didn't have to give the government a dime. And the evidence was that they collected $44 million over the 2 years of the contract.
I took it that the evidence was what they collected, or was, in fact, less than what they budgeted for.
Not, Your Honor, not what they budgeted for, what they're projected. They had a some type of formula.
Right. They made some internal projections. As a result of those internal projections, they responded to the solicitation's directive to show us how much you're giving us back, kind of by reducing the price because you're going to get some money from scrap, and they offered, I don't know, $20 million or something reduction. But in fact, they got a lot. What turned out to happen with the scrap was quite different from what they had expected.
You know, not to quibble, but quite different is a qualitative, if you will, concept.
I have some numbers. I was just trying to skip.
No, I understand that, Your Honor. They projected $57 million over the first 2 years. They received $44 million over the first 2 years.
And how does this go to whether there was a negligent estimate or reasonable inaccuracy or failure to reveal severe knowledge, as opposed to damages or which might come later?
It sort of blends over all three or all four of those concepts. Because when you look at the negligent estimate or superior knowledge, The issue becomes, was Agility surprised that there was an increase in workload? And no. The evidence in the proposal where it says property turn-ins would increase put them on notice that the workload could increase. And in fact, you had Clause H-19. In their proposal, Agility had a paragraph which said, when there is a surge, we will move requirements among the different bases to handle it. So they also knew through that it would increase. But then most importantly, we have the sales proceeds. The sales proceeds allowed them to keep free and clear. And when the government announced that, they also said that it was hoped that the contractor would use the sales proceeds to offset the cost of performance. And there was a requirement that they had to show how the government would reap a benefit. In its proposal, Agility stated that over the course of the 5 years, they had reduced their contract price by $20 million. It was front-loaded over the first 2 years, so over the first 2 years, they discounted their price by $11 million. They received $44 million. That left $30 million free and clear profit. And yet,
wait a second. Free and clear is one thing. Profit is a quite different thing. They don't have to give anything to the government, but free and clear does not equate profit, because they might have had $29 million in costs to get that.
Your Honor, in terms of the trial testimony, the evidence and Mr. Frede, who was their chief financial officer at the time, stated that we reimbursed ourselves from that $44 million, the $11 million that they discounted.
Right.
I may have misspoke by using the phrase free and clear because they were unable to say what other costs were involved in that $30 million. But the most important thing is that they received $30 million more than they had, when I say anticipated, than the contract price. And the government stated that
it... I remember, did Judge Wheeler make any findings about that?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe near the end of the opinion, he stated just what I stated, that when we look at the... when we look at the contract, and he does talk about, to some extent, the sales proceeds. May I have a minute here?
Of course. I see, and under the conclusion, is that the...
Yeah. It's J18
under the conclusion paragraph.
Correct, Your Honor.
Although Agility faced workload significantly in excess of what it anticipated, Agility still received over $44 million in scrap proceeds, that's not profits, over the 27 months of the contract. The fact that the proceeds were a bunch lower than Agility's projections doesn't move the equities in our...
Yes, case. Your Honor. And that's what I was arguing. I may have been a little dogmatic by saying profit or free and clear, but the bottom line is that they received more in the sales proceeds, or they received the addition sales proceeds with the notion that they would offset the cost of performance. The government didn't know how to predict the requirements. Trying to predict troop movements, as the judge found, was almost impossible. But when you look at what Agility is asking, they're asking for, in essence, to divulge national security estimates. Because if you know when you're going to draw down troops or move troops...
Or surge troops,
why would you publish it in a public document a year, two, three, four, 5 years in advance?
Well, maybe then you just don't have the option of offering a requirements contract in your solicitation if you can't actually provide an estimate to go along with it in compliance with your own FAR regulations.
Your Honor, I understand that point, but we also look at the discretion that is afforded to contracting officials in procurement.
Well, there's no discretion in the FAR regulation. The FAR regulation is a regulation that binds every one of those contracting officials.
That's correct, but I was focusing more on the type of contract that's left to the discretion.
Okay, your time...
I know, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Austin. Do you have anything further you'd like to add?
I just touch on a couple things very briefly, Your Honor. During my initial argument, Your Honor had asked and made a comment about how we thought we met H-19, at least at Dermo Arif John, and that is in on pages 60 and 61 of our principal brief, and that's just meant to address a comment the court made.
Okay.
We didn't get into H-19, but we thought we needed to address it just in case it was important to the court. Mr. Austin spoke about a pre-award survey, and I believe the testimony at trial came from Mr. Baker, that pre-award survey occurred in the spring of 2007, the early stage of the proposal process. And then there was a dispute that was one the trial court resolved, frankly, in our favor. The government contended that there was only about 15,000 line items at most on the ground at Arif John. We contended it was 70,000. The trial court found it was 70,000. And so, you know, the issue about the pre-award survey, that was, you know, final proposal revisions were in September. The award was made in November. The government operated this DERMOS until February. And so there's no evidence of inspection between final proposal submissions and award and then the first day of performance. The last thing I want to touch on just briefly, a couple things, as it relates to the scrap sales. To us, the government's assertion that the scrap proceeds were supposed to offset costs is true, and it did. The independent government cost estimate was $73 million. Our proposal was $45 million. The highest of the three offers was $71, the next lowest was $68. The government got the benefit of the cost savings on the front end, and it told Agility it could have the scrap free and clear. But the idea of free and clear is sort of inconsistent with the notion that you can have it free and clear as long as you first apply it all to offset any additional costs of performance. That's essentially an inchoate lien on these scrap proceeds. It's not free and clear if we have to apply it to offset additional costs. And then the last thing about the troop movements, you know, I know Judge Wheeler mentioned that in his opinion. Just like we didn't really dispute the scrap estimate because we had one, We never really thought about troop movements. We mentioned there were some instances in the record where the government mentioned troop movements. But certainly we agree with Judge Wheeler, that wouldn't have been that helpful. A platoon of medical professionals is going to be different than a tank battalion. And so we, unless we know what they have, that's not going to help us. The point was, the singular motivating factor, as the trial court found, in the government's decision to award this contract in the first place, was its knowledge that its staff was going to be overrun. That was never shared with Office Corps. We were told to bid to a set of requirements that its staff could have performed, and even given the number of people it took to perform that work. All the while, they knew that that was not going to be the requirement we were intended to meet, and they even evaluated proposals against that information. We see at least two instances where Agility's proposal was deemed deficient. Marlo Burns, who probably knows more about staffing at Dermo than anybody in the world, testified that he reviewed Agility's proposal when he was on the source selection evaluation team. He thought it was going to be.
Can I ask you, this is, I guess, a version of a question I asked you when you were up here the first time. Suppose, for purposes of this question, that you prevail here on negligent estimate and even the warranty. Does it matter whether you also prevail on failure to disclose superior knowledge? Obviously, there are, even on the two that I took as a premise for this question, there will be issues on remand, reliance in its forms, damages if one overcomes reliance. The superior knowledge claim is has potentially broader consequences, and I'm trying to figure out whether that needs to be addressed.
I think they're interrelated. You know, the reason the negligent or the estimate was negligent was because the government knew at the time we were bidding to it that it doesn't accurately reflect the requirements that they knew were coming and that motivated them to award the contract in the first place. And so if the court finds the estimate was negligent, or if it focuses on either portion of the estimate, then I think it also necessarily has to find that it wasn't reasonable or realistic because of the government's knowledge. And so they bleed together. And I would say that it matters only in the sense that one finding necessarily, we think, results in another.
Okay.
I see my time is up.
Thank you very much. I thank both counsel for a very good argument.